Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
In 1986, Sharon Fulton disappeared in Perth. She dropped her children at school in the morning, but wasn't there in the afternoon. For decades, nothing happened until suddenly her husband was charged and put on trial for her murder. I'm Stephen Stockwell. This is episode one of the case of Sharon's disappearance.
Special Crime Squad detectives extradited Reddington back to Perth.
They were experiencing marriage difficulties and Reddington thought he would suffer financially if she left him.
I am instructed to assert that he protests his innocence.
Today it's about my mother, Sharon, a dedicated, loving mother. Mum, you are not forgotten. You are not erased. You are not just a case file.
That's the voice of Heath Fulton. He was 3 years old when his mother, Sharon Fulton, disappeared, and him and his three siblings have been waiting 40 years for answers. Earlier this year, they watched as their own father was put on trial for Sharon's murder. His name is Raymond Reddington, but when Sharon Fulton went missing, he was Robert Fulton, and the reasons for this name change are something we'll dig into a little bit later. Throughout this story, there are anonymous tips that backfire, the suggestion that serial killers could have been behind Sharon's disappearance, and a secret recording, Heath taping himself, asking his father what happened to his mother. There is so much in this story, and to unpack it all, we're joined by Perth ABC court reporter David Webber. Welcome, David.
Yeah, good day.
David, as a court reporter in Perth, what intrigued you most about this case?
The fact that there was no body, the fact that the time between the prosecution and the events was so long, 40 years, and while people remember the last time they saw her, there were no witnesses to the crime. The interesting thing about this one was the challenge for the prosecution because of the lack of evidence. Other murder trials, including ones that have finished just recently, what you end up with a couple of people who are accused of murder and they all blaming each other. And that's what it comes down to. But there's little argument about the fact that somebody is deceased because you have a body, you have a post-mortem, and you have all of this other evidence in the court, which makes it less of a challenge for the prosecution to convince a jury that a murder has occurred. But in this case, they had to convince the jury that a murder had occurred. The lack of evidence, I think, is what stood out to me. And from the very beginning, you sort of thought, wow, this is going to be very difficult for the prosecution. Probably easier for the defence in some ways to say, well, there's nothing there. There's nothing here to prove what you say has happened.
Raymond Reddington is charged with the murder of Sharon Fulton, his wife, the mother of his four children, the youngest of them, 3 years old. This seems like such a mystery, David. How does a mother of four just disappear without any charges laid for 40 years?
I'm not aware of anything like this in Western Australia. There has been at least one other case in Australia that I'm aware of. Of course, it's Chris Dawson that bears similarities. Nobody, your circumstantial case, sort of pieces of a jigsaw being put together.
When was she last seen?
So in March 1986, according to her husband, he'd said that he'd come home and she wasn't there. But then he later said that he had dropped her off at a train station. So he gave different versions of events. But the last time anyone actually saw her was her children in the morning. They were being prepared to go to school as she usually did, various schools, high school, primary school, and in the case of Heath, a place called the Sound and Coordination Centre in Wangara, because he was only 3 years old. So the children would have been the last people to see her alive, aside from her husband, Robert Fulton.
Yeah. And did she have a series of appointments that day that you know, she didn't rock up with that kind of raised concerns amongst some of the friends and you know, people that she'd associate with in Perth?
So the court heard that she had dropped her son Heath at the Sound Coordination Centre in Wangarra. So the family home was in Duncraig, which is a northern Perth suburb, and Wangarra is slightly inland. There was a plan to go to something that was known as a print party, a bit like a Tupperware party where people turned up to have a look at decorative prints. This print party was going to be held in Bayswater, which is a suburb closer to the Perth CBD. And the plan was that she was going to go there. She did actually ring the house and say, can I bring my son Heath? And she never arrived.
What do the children remember about that day?
So Derek, being in his mid-teens, he was the one with the clearest memories of his mother. He was at high school at the time. He had told the court he remembers mum getting breakfast together and getting them all off to school. He remembers that he would usually leave at about 10 to 9, but his younger siblings would leave about 8:30. The two middle kids began to primary school, and Heath obviously to the Sound Coordination Learning Centre. And he's just said it was a normal school day that day. But when he came home, he felt like he was getting uneasy. He said he seemed out of the ordinary that mum wasn't there. And then he got there was a phone call from his dad asking him to go and grab the other kids from the primary school. So he actually explained how he left the house, went up pathways and crossed a couple of soccer fields. And the kids, he said, sort of a little bit panicky. They were waiting there for a little while, but he picked them up and brought them home. And dad turned up sometime later, was his account, whereas Heath was only 3 years old. So he obviously doesn't have super clear memories of what happened. We had heard from someone from the Sound Coordination Centre who said that Raymond Reddington or Robert Fulton back then was the one who picked up Heath later than Sharon Fulton should have picked him up from the centre. And he had said he had car troubles. And then Heath did have a memory of going to a train station. And the reason he remembers that is because there's a kind of broken up train mural at one of those stations. And he remembers that as a kid. And he sort of had an idea that later, that maybe this was to make him think that they were looking for his mother, because over time he became more suspicious.
Right. After Sharon Fulton doesn't show at that party, is it immediately suspicious? I mean, how seriously do police look into her disappearance at the time?
Well, they were informed by Robert Fulton, the husband, a few days later that his wife had gone missing. It doesn't seem that there are any other alarm bells that were being raised. She was being treated as a missing person. She'd never been missing before. They had had marriage problems for some time, but decided at Christmas time, Christmas 1985, to give it a further go. And he'd come back and said to the home and said his wife had just left. And the day before, he told police she had said that she needed time for herself. The police report said husband thinks she may have a boyfriend, as she had had one before. And some clothing had been was gone from the house to further suggest that she had left the family for time to have time to herself. And interestingly, one part of the report, said was the complainant or the husband agreeable to publicity, and the answer was no.
David, that publicity reference is really interesting. So what does that mean? That he didn't want to do any press conferences or interviews about what had happened?
There was evidence from some people that he was genuinely distraught days after he said that she'd gone missing. But in those times, it would have really been through mainstream media. People who would have been watching TV news, of course, no internet in people's homes at the time. There would have been a newspaper campaign, the newspapers in Western Australia at the time. Potentially front page. Police would have, they would have been done press conferences, but they would have also been backgrounding reporters to say, we just don't have any leads on this, and her husband is really distraught. And that kind of publicity would make people think, gee, what about that thing I saw the other day? Or that thing that was out of the ordinary? So in this case, there doesn't seem to have been that kind of effort, because police, by and large, believed what Robert Fulton had told them about the last time he saw his wife In both cases, she came, you know, that he came home, she wasn't there, and then days later said, "Oh, in fact, I dropped her off at a train station, and she was going to meet someone." And while that may have rung some alarm bells, it wasn't enough to target him and charge him with anything at the time.
When Robert Fulton, Raymond Reddington, kind of says he doesn't want to do publicity, I mean, David, is that something that sticks out to you as being a little bit odd, a little bit suspicious maybe?
Yes, if you really want to find somebody, you go to police. He left it for a few days, and some explanation he gave later was that you're not supposed to, or police can't do anything until somebody's been missing for a few days. That is kind of true to an extent. Police have to ensure that they haven't touched their bank accounts and all that kind of stuff, but there is a period of time that they leave before they actually start investigating as a missing person. Now, whether Robert Fulton knew that back then or whether he was just running a line, only he knows. But certainly police, if they'd been advised by a man who was seriously concerned about his wife being missing and was completely out of character, especially because, you know, she had the four children, she was devoted to them, she was part of their daily routine, getting them off to school while he worked at the RAF base. It was completely out of character, and that's what stands out.
What do we know about the Fultons? I mean, is this a family that was kind of born and raised in Perth, or were they transplanted into the city?
Essentially, they came over from Queensland via, they've been in Malaysia, they were a RAF family. So Robert Fulton, Maxwell Robert Fulton, his full name at the time, worked at the RAF airbase at Pearce. So this is an airbase outside of Perth, quite a prominent airbase. He had gone to Malaysia, posted there, and the family members had all relocated to Perth. There were friends that Sharon Fulton had in Perth. She was an avid 10-pin bowler. And there was a friend that she knew from the eastern states that happened to be relocated here as well. So not complete strangers to everybody in Perth, but they hadn't actually grown up here as a family. Sharon Fulton was a stay-at-home mum, essentially. She was doing things for all the four kids, ranging in age from mid-teens to three, in suburban Perth, which is Duncraig. And Robert Fulton was the one who went off to work at the RAF Air Base, kinds of hours that you would have as a military person.
Yeah. David, I want to spend a bit of time kind of breaking down the names here, because we have Robert Fulton, the husband of Sharon Fulton, who goes missing. He's the man on trial for her murder here. He's also known as Raymond Reddington. What's going on with his name here?
So Raymond Reddington is a made-up name from a TV show. So Maxwell Robert Fulton, known as Robert Fulton back in the 80s and for some period of time, he changed his name to Raymond Reddington. And that is a name that it would seem comes from a TV show that starred James Spader. And the TV show was known as The Blacklist. It was an American crime drama that was shown on NBC. It was actually the name of a series finale. In that TV series, James Spader played the character of Raymond Reddington.
Yeah, right. Such a strange kind of, I don't know, name change to have to deal with. As this is coming up and kind of finding its way into court, I mean, there's such a long time between, you know, Sharon's disappearance and this trial. I mean, it's 40 years from basically one to the other here. Raymond Reddington, then Robert Fulton, was charged in 2023, and the whole thing finally finds its way to the Perth Supreme Court. How does the prosecution open its case once this goes before a jury? You know, what story do they start to tell about what Raymond Reddington is supposed to have done?
Well, yeah, clearly it's a circumstantial case. The prosecutor said that their case was that she was attacked, most likely in the family home, and her body was disposed of in a way that's never been determined. The evidence was more about the lies that he told over the years, and the motive perhaps being, or as it was being put by the prosecution, was the life insurance policy had been taken out in her name. But also before that, the marriage difficulties that I referred to before had led to her initiating a family court action or going to see a lawyer to perhaps look at the possibility of breaking up with her husband, and she would have the kids. And as the prosecutor said, he stood to lose everything as a result of that. She wanted the house, she wanted the car, she wanted some money. to be able to support her and the children. She was a stay-at-home mum. She didn't have the option to be going to work. That's kind of typical of the time. Mm. You wouldn't necessarily get all of those things, but he was, I guess, from the prosecution's point of view, staring down the barrel of not just losing his wife and access to the kids, but the issue being that he was really going to lose everything.
Yeah. Tell me about this life insurance policy. What was the timing of that being taken out and the amount of money that he stood to make from that?
In Ben Stanwyck saying that he stood to lose just about everything, he also made the point that he stood to gain significantly from her death. There was a life insurance policy taken out in her name, around $120,000, a very significant amount of money in those. I mean, it's still significant now, but back in 1986, a very significant amount of money, taken out weeks before she disappeared. So that was sitting there. There wasn't an attempt to claim on that immediately after her disappearance. I would suggest that would have raised alarm bells. It wasn't until some years later that he tried to claim. And it's a little bit vexed, that issue. It wasn't detailed in court, the extent to which he was paid out. But from what I understand, there was a partial payment because the company was suspicious.
Mm.
However, the thing is that this insurance policy was taken out before she passed away, before she disappeared, and that being a motive as put forward by the prosecution.
Yeah. We're talking a bit about the kind of the version of the story that Raymond Reddington, then Robert Fulton, told police at the time that Sharon Fulton disappeared. I mean, was that something the prosecutors highlighted in their opening, whether or not that story changed over time?
So initially the story to police was he came home and she wasn't there and looked, some clothes are missing.
Mm.
Then the story changed to I dropped her off at a train station. The train station tended to change, which train station it was tended to change in the telling. So initially showing a detective the empty space in the wardrobe where the clothes had gone, and then within days he said, oh, look, you know, what really happened is I took her to a railway station so she could meet someone in town, and then that person called me to say that she hadn't arrived. And then there was another version saying she'd gone to the city on business. In that version, he dropped her off at Mount Lawley train station. In another version, dropped her off at a rail station to visit a friend for a short period, and then later to a subsequent partner, he had said that the Burneys killed her, well-known serial killer couple in late 1986.
David, you know, you mentioned the lies that Reddington told, forming a key part of the prosecution case against him. I mean, are those lies the stories that he told changing, or were there other things that he had lied about?
Well, the key lies, of course, were his different versions of events. The children, in their evidence, said that nothing was ever said, really, about her disappearance. It was something that just wasn't talked about. There were what would seem to be some efforts to try and create a picture to help support his claim that she'd gone to a train station. So with Heath, for instance, he remembers Dad going to a service counter at the train station, so that he was only 3 years old, but he would then perhaps remember, oh yes, we did go looking for Mum at the train station, so she must have left. But what does stick out is that initially, oh, I came home, she wasn't there, and then, oh, I actually dropped her off at a train station, she was going to meet a bloke.
Yeah. David, that's the prosecution case against Raymond Reddington, Robert Fulton. What about the defence case? Where did the defence kind of take the argument or take the discussion to try to convince a jury that Raymond Reddington, Robert Fulton, was not guilty of the murder of Sharon Fulton?
So Jonathan Davies was representing Raymond Reddington, and he told the jury the case was built on circumstance, no direct evidence of any crime, was the quote. And they said it's not a technicality, you can't be convicted on suspicion alone. He said, no body, no confession, no weapon, no crime scene. No witnesses saw any killing. And he said it was a tunnel, or suggested it was a tunnel vision investigation. Sharon Fulton intended to take a short break, and what happened after that is unknown. The other thing that he floated was the idea that what he referred to as active serial killers at the time may have been involved. That was suggested by Raymond Reddington, Robert Fulton, to a later partner, the Burneys were involved. So that was something that was pushed in court as well. And that's where we sort of see this tunnel vision. Well, maybe they should have looked at them or perhaps other serial killers who were active at the time. Nobody and no murder weapons. So very challenging case for the prosecution to prove without that key evidence.
Raymond Reddington, David, you know, through the trial, he's almost 80 years old at this point. How did he look in court?
So he was in a wheelchair. They didn't explain to the jury in court, as long as I was there, as to why he was in a wheelchair. And it's neither here nor there. I mean, it needs to be remembered, he wasn't in a wheelchair in 1986. He was really impassive for the trial, as long as I could see him. He basically just sat there and watched what was going on. That's not different to a lot of people who are on trial charged with murder or serious crimes. You rarely hear from them unless they actually take the stand or if there's an outburst from the dock or something like that. But that's pretty rare. And in this case, it didn't happen.
David, there is so much to unpack in this trial. There are so many twists and so many turns. In our next episode, I'm really interested and keen to unpack the 80 serial killers who you mentioned in this episode who were kind of brought into the frame throughout this. Also, some of the last people that Sharon Fulton spoke to before she disappeared and how her children have been involved in bringing Raymond Reddington to this point. David, thank you so much for spending the time and taking us through this episode.
No worries.
Our next episode will be in your feed on Thursday. Make sure you grab ABC Listen, best place to listen to The Case Of, and a whole heap of other wonderful Australian content. Be back in your feed very soon. The Case of Sharon's Disappearance is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by David Webber and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Whadjuk Noongar and Wurundjeri people.